Thank you so much for the kind words. And I really am grateful to get this strategically placed seminar slot at the Entanglement Program. So my talk will be based on a number of papers that are spread over several years, actually. And all of them are in collaboration with my colleagues and students here. And at the end, I'll talk about... Actually, the bulk of really new stuff is in this paper with Simone Giombi last September, and now we're working some more on this and trying to sharpen this stuff about essentially continuing FCRM to continuous dimension and using epsilon expansion to calculate F for interacting theories, which appears to work far better than we expected initially. So let me start with a review of C theorems, which, you know, as you know, it's been a very active topic. And in a nutshell, you can summarize it with one simple picture. You have one conformal fixed point, which is a short distance UV fixed point. Then there is some relevant operator turned on, which causes RG flow to another fixed point, or this could be actually a trivial theory. And then the C theorems generally say that there is a quantity C such that an inequality is obeyed. CUV is bigger than CIR. I guess people would call it the weak statement of the C theorem, but it looks pretty strong to me because it can rule out a whole bunch of flows that one can speculate, but just rule them out by looking at this theorem. So in general, it's a sort of deep problem in quantum field theory to define a good measure of the number of degrees of freedom. Although I used to always talk about the degrees of freedom, but then maybe I want to soften this, because even the connection with the degrees of freedom, once you go beyond two dimensions, can be a little murky. But there should be just a well-defined quantity which obeys this rigorous inequality. And that's already a very powerful constraint on RG flows. And then in so this whole game was basically started in two-dimensional conformal field theory by Alexandra Zamolochikov, who, using two-point functions of the stress tensor, found so he used the constraints of Lorentz invariance and two-point functions of T mu nu, and defined it's literally a three-line proof, a C function which satisfies the monotonicity property, and it also happens to be stationary at the fixed points, which is a really beautiful classic result. Now, this quantity C, basically in two dimensions, all roads lead to C, right? There are so many different ways to think about C. One is that it's a Weyl anomaly. If you study the trace of the stress energy tensor on a curved manifold, then C is the coefficient of proportionality. It's also the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. Namely, if you look at the thermal free energy, then you find that that F is proportional to C times the length times T squared. So it measures the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. And then probably more importantly for this program, it also determines the entanglement entropy of a segment of size R in a conformal field theory. Basically, the coefficient is C over 3 times log R. There is this logarithmic dependence. And then actually using this idea, one can prove the C theorem in another way. This was done by Cassini and Huerta by using the boost invariance and strong subadditivity. They had a very beautiful short proof also that that CUV is bigger than CIR. But one interesting thing about this entanglement C function that they defined, so they basically looked at in their story, if you use this idea, then it turned out that there was this C function C of R, which was R ds by dr. And this can be used even in any Lorentz invariant theory, but this turned out to be not stationary, for example, for a scalar field. But it was good enough to prove the theorem. And I'll come back a little bit to the discussion of the stationarity issue when they talk about F. Now, and more important for me also that another way to think about C is to think, and this is related to the Weyl anomaly, of course, we can think about the partition function on the sphere and the sphere free energy F, which is minus log Z. That's proportional to log of the radius of the sphere. And for historical reasons, this coefficient here is minus C over 3. But I want to say later that this is actually an example of a generalized A theorem. This is an A-type theorem because it lives in even dimensions. You just happen to define C equal 1 for a scalar field. So with this definition, A is just C over 3. So that's a preliminary. Now, what about generalizing to higher dimensions? Well, so one of the originators of this is, of course, John Cardy, who very soon after Zamolodchyka wrote a remarkable paper called Is There a C Theorem in Four Dimensions? He didn't call it an A theorem then, but now it's known as the A theorem. And basically, the route to go, he actually went the sphere route. If you read the paper, he studies the theory on the fourth sphere. The upshot is that in four dimensions, there are two Weyl anomaly coefficients. One is called A now, and it multiplies the Euler density, the four-dimensional Euler density. And the other one is the Weyl squared. So this one doesn't matter on the sphere, because on the sphere, the Weyl tensor just vanishes. And this one comes in on the sphere. And John conjectured that that basically this A always decreases on the under any RG flow. So A is the right C quantity, so to speak. And the way to extract this A is to, again, compute the partition function on the fourth sphere, take minus the log, and then this is normalized like this. So with this normalization, actually, it's 1/90th for a conformally coupled scalar field, not 1/3. And then it goes down further. I like this universal normalization, then in six dimensions, it's minus 1 over 756 and so on. And actually, the sign alternates, which will be important. Of course, this has been one of the major currents in four-dimensional field theory. People seem to be finding counterexamples, but then they went away. And then finally, a proof was provided about 4 years ago by Kamargotsky and Schwimmer. But still, I mean, it's a very fruitful topic and would be very nice to understand deeper how all these things work. And then, of course, this begs the question, since the 2D and 4D examples had to do with Weyl anomalies, how do we generalize it to odd dimensions and maybe more generally to non-integer dimensions? And then... And somehow a few years ago, based on research on supersymmetric field theories and localization, we stumbled on a very simple idea, which we didn't realize at first had to do with entanglement, but then it was explained to us shortly thereafter. It's essentially just to go the sphere route, just study the theory on the sphere in odd dimensions, and then... And then the idea is that this is a completely well-defined finite quantity. Now there is no log R term, and the quantity is totally regulator independent. And this in itself requires some explanation. Like, why is that? Because if you just do raw computations, you find cubic divergences, you find linear divergences. But the trick is that these divergences are proportional to terms that violate Weyl invariance. So there are no basically geometrical terms that are Weyl invariant that you could possibly add. And therefore, there are no possible Weyl invariant divergences. So these terms are forbidden abstractly by conformal invariance. And this means that after they're dealt with properly, you find a kind of non-local regulator independent quantity. And the conjecture is that F theorem is the right odd dimensional C theorem, namely FIR is less than FUV. So that's the proposal. And this is very much connected with entanglement. So abstractly, you would say, what does this quantity have to do with physics? Because it's a rather abstract operation. Take a conformal field theory, map it to a round sphere. But it turns out that it does measure something physical. Namely, it measures the amount of long-range entanglement for a particular geometry in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Namely, the geometry is that you just work in 2 plus 1. You draw a circle of radius r. And then this circle, of course, as usual, this circle will have some short-range entanglement proportional to the perimeter length of the circle measured in lattice units. And then the subleading term is what you would call f. Now, many of you are familiar with calling this f gamma and calling this topological entanglement entropy. This is true in various gap theories. But the remarkable thing in 2 plus 1 dimensions is that this is also true in gapless theory, in gapless conformal theories. And one can also take some theories which are parity breaking, so they have both Chern-Simons terms and massless degrees of freedom, like three-dimensional QED, and then they kind of get mixed up together. They no longer separate. But this general fact that the 2 plus 1 dimensional circle entropy is related to the partition function on the three-dimensional Euclidean sphere was explained by Cassini, Huerta, and Myers based on some earlier work by Cassini and Huerta on free fields. They already had examples of that on free fields. And they gave a very beautiful argument, which essentially had to do with studying the density matrix in this theory, then mapping it to the Sitter space. And then, of course, the sphere is Euclidean de Sitter, so that's how you get this sphere. And then, actually, this F theorem was formulated using the language of entanglement first by Myers and Sinha, and was later proved by Cassini and Huerta. Now, the C function that they used in the proof is the so-called renormalized entanglement entropy. It's a clever combination that was proposed by Liu and Mazet somewhat earlier. It's a combination of the entanglement S of R and R times the derivative of entanglement. And it's precisely such that this divergent term 2 pi r over epsilon just cancels off, and then you're left with a completely finite term. So even before the general proof, which is rather complicated, if you just study some explicit examples, you quickly become convinced. For example, it's not hard to compute. So the most sort of basic example of 2 plus 1 dimensional RG flow is just a massive scalar field. This theory in the UV is, of course, just a conformal theory of one scalar field. And then the mass causes it to flow to a trivial theory. And then so one can do a numerical computation using Mark Srednitsky's radial discretization method. And then if one plots this renormalized entanglement, this particular combination, you immediately unmistakably see that it's monotonic and it heads down to zero. So at large MR squared, it falls to zero. I won't go through the general proof, which is rather complicated. And then you see that MR equals zero, which is the conformal value. It's some number which is slightly bigger than 0.06. But it's very hard to analytically calculate this number. And then another sort of complication here is that this particular C function is not monotonic, actually. Sorry, not stationary at zero mass. And this is still, like, in some sense, not analytically proven, but I think there is enough precision and other evidence that it really isn't always stationary. It's not clear what to read into this. It's probably still fine, but one could imagine looking for better C function. So it's not as golden as the Zamolodchikov C function, where you kind of arrive at the fixed point very gently, as you're supposed to. So I think that it still would be nice to sharpen the proof of the theorem and to find a completely globally defined monotonic and stationary C function. So this is work of a couple years ago, actually. And now I want to switch to partly old, partly new work, which is Of course, abstractly, it's a good thing to know this inequality, but to make it informative, you want to be able to calculate this quantity f in a variety of theories. And so one route is just numerical route, which sometimes can be very precise, for example, using this Riednitsky method for free fields. But we want to have also some analytical power and so on. So let's just come back and try to understand the 0.06 better. So as I advertised, this has to do with the F for the sphere. So it's no trouble to compute the, so the operator for the conformally coupled scalar on the sphere in D dimensions is this. There is this coupling to curvature, and this removes the zero mode. For D bigger than 2, this removes the zero mode, and then you have just some divergent quantity, which actually suffers from the type of UV divergences that I talked about, but we all know that this, for example, zeta function regularization is usually nice and invariant. You carry it out, and you get this analytic answer, like log 2 over 8 minus 3 zeta of 3 over 16 pi squared. And this is indeed right on the nose, same as this numerical result. So for free fields, this is okay in three dimensions. But moreover, one can actually go further and use the same type of analytic continuation methods to do this, to derive a formula in continuous dimension. And here is the formula. I'll motivate it a little better in a second. It's actually related to the determinant of the operator, which is like 1 over chordal distance to some power, which is just the inverse of this operator. That's sort of the easy. And then you can expand it in normal modes, carry out the computation, and you get this integral representation. But then you actually, one thing I want to highlight is that this tends to be a finite integral. And then there is this 1 over sine pi d over 2, which diverges in even dimensions. But this is exactly as it should be, because even dimensions have the anomaly. So as you approach the even dimensions, you expect this as a sign of this appearing log r, you expect this 1 over epsilon to show up. And this formula, for example, near 4 dimensions, it indeed has this 1 over 90 epsilon. So the coefficient is always A over epsilon. And similarly, you can do it in, for example, near 6, it's going to give you this 1 over 756, and so on and so forth. So it's a very nifty formula. And just jumping a little ahead, we will actually define a kind of generalized F quantity, which is just this with sine pi d over 2 removed from the denominator. We just multiply it by sine pi d over 2. And then it turns out to be a completely smooth and monotonic function of dimension, which is very epsilon expansion friendly. One can expand it.
Does this thing change? You said this thing changes sign?
Yeah, it turns out that so sine pi d over 2, of course, changes sign, like from 3 to 5 to 7. Once you multiply it by sine pi d over 2, it's nice. It's completely positive. Yeah. So in the paper we wrote in 11, we just phenomenologically inserted the sign because we also thought about 5 and higher odd dimensions. So you need this minus 1 to the d plus 1 over 2. This formula automatically has it kind of. So that's actually an important point, it seems, in this. Okay, so another thing that one can do analytically is the so-called conformal perturbation theory, where one considers very slightly relevant operators. This is really something that Zamolodchikov and Cardi did in 2 and 4 dimensions, respectively. It's a very nice method because this epsilon, which is now the difference between delta and d, gives you analytic control. And we, with Pufu and Sabdi, carried it out first on the three sphere, and now we're thinking about it in more general terms. Actually, Giombi is mainly thinking about it. So one can just do this expansion in powers of the interaction, and then the one-point function automatically vanishes by conformal invariance here. So then this quantity is automatically stationary. There is no problem with that. And then the 2 and 3 point functions can be calculated using the Cardy integrals. So John Cardy computed them back in his seminal paper in, was it 87? So using these integrals, one just expands this f in powers of bare coupling and these integrals, and then does expresses bare coupling in terms of renormalized coupling, and then you actually get a very, very amusing result. So the beta function is universally known. That's from John Cardy's paper. But then you find that this three-dimensional f indeed is such that its derivative is the beta function up to a constant of proportionality. And this immediately buys you stationarity, because that means that this is literally an expression of stationarity at the fixed point, the fact that this beta function appears here. And this works because if you want to study, so whenever there is this coefficient C, which is the OPE of two vertex operators into the third one, you get a weakly coupled robust fixed point. And this fixed point sits at G proportional to epsilon over C. And then you you plug this in and you find that the change of sphere free energy F indeed decreases, and it's proportional to epsilon cubed. So this is a kind of proof of F theorem in this perturbative regime. Whenever this works, this proves the F theorem. And I should remark that the smallest odd dimension is, of course, D equal 1. And in fact, if you read the Affleck-Ludwig's papers from the early 90s, they were doing very similar things. And of course, it's hard to find the really standalone one-dimensional CFTs, but you can think of them as living at the boundary of two dimensions. And then a very similar story works. And then actually, when I was thinking about it back then, I realized that they were taking the opposite sign. So for them, the decreasing thing was log z and not minus log z. So as you go from 1 to 3, you got to change sign. Then you got to change sign again. So the universal quantity, which seems to work in all odd dimensions, is this minus 1 to the d plus 1 over 2 times f. That's what, of course, there is not even close to a proof, but it's a reasonable thing to conjecture based on these exercises and where you have analytic control. And then another type of cases where you have analytic control are large N theories with double trace perturbation. So if you have a single trace operator phi, then phi squared is double trace. And then you can use the so-called Hubbard-Stratonovich method by adding an auxiliary field. And then you essentially get a controllable RG flow in this large N theory. And then the change of f can then be also written down as a certain determinant. And this is degeneracy of the modes on the sphere. And we started doing it with Steve Gubser, but then Diaz and Dorn actually very nicely pushed it forward and derived this type of analytic formula for change of f under double trace deformation. And then again, it decreased. So it again was in the... I mean, they didn't know about F theorem then. They were mainly concerned about even dimensions, but it decreases in odd dimensions. And when you look at this formula, you see that it's practically the same one that I was writing for scalar fields, except I was putting in one here. So if you take this formula and plug in delta equal to d over 2 minus 1, which is the dimension of a free scalar, you get exactly minus the right answer. This has to do with the fact that you're computing the determinant of this. Essentially, the operator you're studying is of this type. You're studying this 1 over chordal distance to some power, expanding it in modes. And this is just the inverse operator of the Laplacian. So this formula works for arbitrary double traces. And again, notice the sine pi d over 2 in the denominator, kind of, it wants to be removed, so to speak. Okay. Of course, in odd dimensions, it's just harmless, right? It's either plus or minus one, but in even dimensions, it's very bad and wants to go. Okay, so for d equals 3, this can be rewritten in this slightly simpler form. And you see that as a function of delta, again, it's always negative. And then when delta is 3/2 and the operator becomes marginal, then it goes to 0. That's somehow a property of all these things. And this allows us to compute the particular case delta equal 1, which corresponds to the O(n) model. So O(n) model is one very simple example of this, because that's a kind of double trace. That's a double trace perturbation, which I'll exhibit in a second. And in this case, this gives you the robust order n to the 0 correction. Right? You get like some term of order n, and then this correction. So now the O(n) model, that's the famous Wilson-Fisher set of CFTs. The interaction term is indeed double trace. It's basically phi I squared.
Yeah, that delta is scaling dimension of the perturbed operator, or?
It's the scaling dimension of 2 delta is the perturbing scaling. Because my operator is phi, right? But let me call it like this. It's O squared, right? So delta is a delta O. Okay, so in the large N, so this is a large N theory. And O is, for example, phi I. Right, so when delta hits 3/2, the dimension of the perturbing operator hits 3 and becomes marginal, up to 1 over n corrections. Okay, and that's exactly what you're seeing. When delta hits 3/2 here, it no longer is a relevant operator, and it doesn't make sense for it to decrease. So exactly at 3/2, it's no longer CFT. You have logarithmic flow of the coefficient of this marginal operator. Okay, so let's just review this model. It's just an O(n) linear sigma model studied in 3 dimensions. And what did we just learn about it? We basically learned by a combination of the free field and double trace results that large N expansion of the Wilson-Fisher CFT F is N times this free field value minus a small correction, zeta of 3 over 8 pi squared, plus some order 1 over N term, which is still not known. We actually tried pretty hard to calculate it. It turns out to be rather pesky to calculate. Like this one, is, as I showed, is really easy. But then we started thinking, actually, do we really want so badly to calculate it? Because as already known, for example, in Wilson-Kogut review, it's already written, 1 over n expansion doesn't work for small n. It's very bad. It doesn't converge so well. So that actually gave us a clue. But let me just finish with this story. So then there is another perturbation that you can, if you take negative m squared, then the theory flows, of course, to the Goldstone phase. And the Goldstone phase has just n minus 1 free massless scalars. So it just has this value. And then you can test the F theorem in this example. And this example is not so trivial because, as pointed out by Subir Sachdev, this is the example where the thermal free energy already is not decreasing. So what Subir showed is that in the critical model, basically the so-called, so there was a conjecture, which I think Eduardo Frotkin was one of the people who made it, was that whether C thermal, which is just the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, whether this could be always a decreasing quantity.
Okay,
yeah, that's right. You showed that some examples where it's not, but still, it's actually very explicitly something that is pretty physical, right? That actually does measure the physical degrees of freedom. But strangely enough, it doesn't always work. And I think one very concrete example where it doesn't work is this this flow that I just talked about. Because for this critical model, the C thermal for this Wilson-Fisher model at large n is proportional to 4/5 n. And for and then it can flow to the C therm for the Goldstone phase, and there is just n minus 1. So obviously for large n, this is not bigger than this, and this immediately fails. But this f actually does work, and you can see that essentially both inequalities are obeyed. And here is actually a phase diagram for this flow. I hope I got this right. I'm not a condensed matter physicist. I should know this, but this is basically the mass. This is the mass squared over mu squared, and this is the lambda. So it's just basically the ON model phase diagram. So this theory one is just a free theory. Prefix point, which is unstable. Two is the critical ON, so free N fields. And three is the Goldstone. Right, you see that the Goldstone is kind of sits at negative M squared, and it's a very robust fixed point because all flow lines lead to it. And in other words, it's a Goldstone, which means that free N minus one fields. And then you can, so the F theorem makes a very definite prediction here. It says that F1 should be bigger than F2, should be bigger than F3. Because the critical ON model is sandwiched between two free theories. And then we see very explicitly how at large N, where we have control, this is satisfied. So, however, you know, you can say this is not like a proof of anything, but it's still, there was some possibility for failure here, and it was avoided. So now let me talk about somewhat more recent work, which gives actually similar results. And we actually realized that at large n, one can even study ON models above four dimensions. This is not a widely appreciated fact, but I think it was known to people in the 70s. One can, for example, just study in 4 plus epsilon dimensions, there is a UV fixed point. The only weird thing is that this UV fixed point sits at negative coupling. So it sits at an unstable potential. But for large n, it's sort of OK. It turns out that these theories are perfectly okay to all orders in 1 over n expansion, and they appear to be only non-perturbatively unstable. So we decided to study these theories at least in 1 over n expansion, and I think we learned some amusing things, even though these theories may not be completely okay. They're basically examples of metastable theories. So if you like study the same Hubbard-Stratonovich trick, you realize that these theories basically can be studied above four dimensions, because at the UV fixed point, this sigma squared term can be ignored, and you can use exactly the same strategy as you used below four dimensions. But there they were IR fixed points. So then we said, like, if there really are these UV fixed points, there must be some UV completion for them. In other words, there should be some other ON invariant theory which flows to these theories. So there should be something like this picture. There should be, like, you can flow from this theory to something else, but you can also flow from another direction. And this would be called the UV completion. And actually, it's not hard to find the UV completion. It turns out to be a theory with an extra scalar and cubic interaction, which is perturbative near six dimensions. So you can study 6 minus epsilon expansion for this theory. ON invariance requires only two terms. Sigma is this extra scalar, And there are two coupling constants, G1 and G2. So you have to study RG flows in this set of two coupling constants. And these interactions are relevant below six dimensions.
So are these theories also somehow metastable?
Yes, yes. These are metastable because there is a sigma cube potential. In fact, we've lately done some work actually calculating instanton effects in these series. And as expected, these effects are of order e to the minus n. Moreover, in 6 minus epsilon dimensions, they turn out to be e to the minus n over epsilon. So there is a further suppression very near 6 dimensions because the theory becomes weakly coupled. So the theory near 6 dimensions is really, for all intents and purposes, stable. Like, the sickness is only of order like 10 to the minus, however small you like it. But let me just be conservative and talk about just the perturbative sector of this theory, and it's not hard to calculate the one loop beta functions, and then you find that at large n there are definitely IR stable fixed points at real couplings. I should remark that the first impetus for studying these type of theories was given by Michael Fisher, who studied just the phi cube theory in 6 minus epsilon dimensions. And he studied he found the IR fixed point at imaginary coupling. And he said, if I continue this to two dimensions, I'll get the Young-Lee edge singularity. But that theory lived at imaginary G and was rather manifestly non-unitary, like it violated unitarity bound already in 6 minus epsilon dimension. These theories are perturbatively unitary because they live at real G1 and G2. And we checked that indeed it's completely correct that these are the UV completions of these ON sigma models. Namely, there are these old large N results from A.N. Vasiliev's group from the early 80s who went up to order 1 over n cubed in some cases, did incredibly complicated computations. So they knew, like, for example, the dimension of phi field, 1 over, they had this 1 over n cubed corrections, but they had an arbitrary function of d. And now we can set d to 6 minus epsilon and compare with our perturbative result, and everything agrees. So we have a kind of new perturbative check on these old large N methods. If you read these old papers, they always talk about the perturbative check in 4 minus epsilon and in 2 plus epsilon. And we essentially found a new perturbative check in 6 minus epsilon for these old kind of classic formula. So we showed that it basically always works. Just to show you that there was due diligence, there is even 3 loop. So I'm blessed with having incredibly strong collaborators. The two graduate students, Faye and Tarnopolsky, did the bulk of this calculation, which was pretty amazing, and summed all these diagrams. Here are the 3 loop beta functions, and then we know 3 loop anomalous dimensions. And then when you go, for example, to epsilon cube order, you really see, like, you can continue to epsilon cube order and you match everything. So it's really, there is no mistake that it works. And then the next question is, what is it good for? So I think, let me just show you that at least it provides a test of this putative 5-dimensional F theorem. Because as I mentioned, it was conjectured that this F tilde, which in this case will be minus F or plus log Z, that this is decreasing under RG flow. And this picture, so now we again have this fixed point sandwiched in between two different descriptions. One is the theory of N free fields, and the other one is the theory of N plus 1 free fields, right? This is what we call the UV completion theory, including extra sigma field, and this is just the IR free theory of N phi fields, right? This is N phi fields plus the sigma, and this F tilde of critical theory should sit in between. And we can test this at large N. We know that we know the value of the free scalar. It's some combination of zetas, which turns out to be this rather small number. And we also know from the method of Hubbard Stratonovich that the correction due to correction of order n to the zero is this number. And indeed, it's such that this inequality is satisfied. So at least it passes the test of this five-dimensional what we called F tilde theorem. Okay, so that's basically the circumstantial evidence. Are there any questions? Okay, so now let me move on to more ambitious stuff, which is can this work actually in some sense in continuous dimension? And as I mentioned, the A theorem can be derived from studying sphere partition functions in four dimensions, right? But you just have to take the anomalous piece, right? So it's very similar, and one can ask whether they can be somehow merged together. And then, as I mentioned, the natural quantity to consider in continuous dimension, at first we were scared of this because F near four dimensions, of course, has this pole. But then going back to all the formula I exhibited, the pole was due to the sine pi d over 2 in the denominator. So let us just multiply this log S by the sine. And then this looks perfect. I mean, in odd D, this reduces to something we've already tested in five and three dimensions. And even in one dimension, Affleck and Ludwig basically tested this in one dimension using conformal perturbation theory. Let's just show some plots. So for example, for the free field, here is the plot of this quantity as a function of D. You see that it's perfectly smooth and monotonic. It has no features at all. And it really smoothly interpolates between anomaly coefficients A and F values, right? So it's really anomaly coefficient times pi over 2. So in four dimensions is this pi over 180, right? So this is the four-dimensional value, then this is the three-dimensional value. So it all looks nice. And you can even, like, just for as a warm-up example, you can start doing 4 minus epsilon expansion of this function and see how well it converges. And after just a few terms, it already gives you a very precise answer. So you can kind of reach the 3D F value from the anomaly by just doing a little bit of epsilon expanding. So this basically motivates us to think whether one could conjecture this theorem in continuous dimension. And this is, of course, an ambitious thing. There is no proof of it at the moment, although I don't think there are any counterexamples either. But let me just adopt a very practical attitude at this point, which is let us just use this quantity to approximate F for interacting theories in three dimensions, right? And it's exactly the Wilson-Fisher idea of epsilon expansion. Okay, so we can apply it to the interacting ON model. I think we have all the ingredients that we need. So let me show you how this works. First of all, let's go back to these cubic fixed points in 6 minus epsilon dimensions. One can essentially perturb in two-point functions of these operators. And essentially, we know that these IR fixed points sit at small values of G1 and G2. And when you use the Cardi integral, do the integral, you find that F tilde is the n plus 1 times the free field answer, and these interaction corrections. And these are actually of order epsilon squared. So this is a complete correction of order epsilon squared. And then there is some higher order term, which is harder to calculate, but this at least already gives you an idea how big the interaction correction is going to be. And then we see when you actually look at this interaction correction, it's automatically positive for the unitary theory. But for Fisher's Yang-Lee theory, it's opposite sign. So you see how this F tilde theorem can certainly be violated for non-unitary theories. But the same is true for C theorem and A theorem. The non-unitary flows can violate it. They don't have to violate it, but they can violate it. Okay, so now here is the, I think, the punchline of the talk. As I was preparing it, I thought that this is a good abbreviation, which is epsilon expansion of entanglement. okay, so the fact that this is, but in fact, we're not expanding the entanglement entropy itself, which is hard, right? It's very hard to think about entanglement entropy. Let's just think about expanding the sphere free energy. And once we get to three dimensions, then it is the actual thing we want. That's the subleading term for the entanglement entropy. And quantitatively, this actually works extremely well, but this does require some work. It requires some work on renormalization of the theory on the sphere. Luckily, we are not the first to think about it. There was a whole school. A lot of people in the UK worked very hard on it in the 80s. And they developed a lot of formalism. I think this was partly motivated by de Sitter, the Euclidean de Sitter approach. So the people who, I mean, the names that come up are Brown and Collins, Hetherell, and also Drummond and Shore wrote a very beautiful paper on studying literally what we need. But they didn't push it all the way to the stage where we need it, but we found this paper very useful. So again, what's this Wilson-Fisher-Owen fixed points? You start with this theory defined with a bare coupling, and then the beta function, these are classic results, they're in many books. One book that I find completely amazing is this book by Kleinert and Schulte Frohlinde, which is 500 pages of renormalization of 5-4 theory and some expansions worked out to the utmost detail. Modular and occasional typo. but this is, you can read their book or some other sources. You see that the renormalized coupling is small for small epsilon, and this allows you to do the epsilon expansion. And here is the result that we get. I should say, yes?
The higher order terms depend on your regularization.
What we seem to,
how are you sure that you're using the same?
What we seem to find is that when you go to the fixed point, then everything is universal.
Oh, yeah. The dependence on epsilon at the fixed point. So
yeah.
There should be. But the value.
I think we. Minimal subtraction.
Minimal subtraction in both cases.
Yes.
Okay.
Whatever Kleiner tells us, we believe. Yeah, he largely uses minimal subtraction. But the beauty of it is that indeed, once you, of course, things are non-universal, but the CFT is universal. So when you set lambda to lambda star, one thing that you find is that when lambda is not equal to lambda star, there are logarithmic terms, which means that the theory is not conformal. And the test of correctness is that they should all cancel. The terms like log mu r must cancel, and this is a test of. I should say that it takes real work. This thing is easy, but this takes real work, and this we're still cleaning it up, because to understand things to this order, you need the curvature counter term. This is where it first comes in, and one needs to understand it well.
That's what I meant, really.
Yeah. You need the curvature counter term. It doesn't come in at this order, but at this order, it's just the Euler density over epsilon to make the theory. So the renormalizability of the theory in the sphere requires these bare curvature couplings. Luckily, Hetherell explained how to do it, and it took us a few months to understand everything, but we believe this is the right answer. And the amazing thing is how small these terms actually happen to be when you, this is already like enough to get a very precise estimate. And then there is another very useful thing. Like suppose we want to understand the Ising model, which is the n equal 1 case. Then we know that f tilde should continue to pi over 12 in two dimensions, because there c is 1/2, right? That's like, you can continue the theory all the way to two dimensions. So this is a big constraint on these Padé approximants. And then what we get is basically that the f value of this theory, which is supposed to be strongly interacting, 3D Ising, is literally only 3% smaller, 2-3% smaller than the free field. And this is just this flow, right, from the free field to the interacting one. And it's in 3D still very, very close. And this is actually, so it's not that surprising because, for example, people who do bootstrap, they cannot compute F, but they can compute CT. And they determined CT of 3D Ising to be like 95% of that of a free scalar. So it's sort of commensurate. And
what are the error bars?
The error bars. I'm not sure I'm prepared to I would say for this, maybe a fraction of a percent, maybe 0.5%. Theirs are really small. I think their latest island technique is they get amazingly small.
So these are compatible.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't computed. This is only for qualitative comparison. Yeah, this is a different quantity.
Oh, it's a different quantity.
Yeah, it's just to show that you can say that both of these quantities are kind of measures of degrees of freedom. One is the measure of entanglement. The other one is the measure of just the stress tensor correlator. CT is just the two-point function. And the fact that
does not satisfy a C theorem.
It wouldn't have to, right. I think it often decreases, but there are, of course, examples where.
Well, we know that perturbatively, I guess it does probably.
But I think in your paper, you already pointed out some counterexamples, right, to CT.
I don't.
But you, yeah, you didn't propose it as a C quantity, even though that's what we call C now, but it's not. So just to give you an idea of the size of these epsilon corrections, this is the free field, and this is the series that you get. So the coefficients of epsilon terms are really tiny. And the difference between the interacting and free field, you see it only shows up in these two terms, and it's a really small difference. So when you Padé approximate this dimension dependence, this is f over f free, you see that it stays very near 1 up until 3 dimensions, and then it dips down to 1/2 rather rapidly below 3 dimensions. So I think this is certainly seems like a very useful tool if you're interested in certain types of entanglement. No, it's very good.
No, but I thought the naive asymptotic series started going bad pretty quickly.
Yeah. But when they did the two-sided Padé, I think it's also rather precise.
Without doing anything, this looks pretty good.
Well, without doing anything, so this is just the raw epsilon expansion. It does deviate. Like, for example, just using this, it doesn't hit 1/2 in D equal to C equal 1/2. It hits like 0.4. It's so just the raw epsilon expansion starts a little bit, but then
it's not an alternating series. That the signs don't alternate because usually they do in there.
But we're not doing the high order. We're not looking at high order terms.
Well, for the for router work, they actually have to
There are ways to, as you say, there is like a large order improvement. Right. So it's basically a bulk of Kleinert's book is about all these different ways of resummation. But I believe that actually just this type of resummation already gives pretty good estimates, but I can't say. Yeah, here is the surprise is like that the numerical values of these corrections just happen to be very, very small. Just the numerical value. Well, yes.
How did you estimate the error bar you mentioned here? But how would you ever?
Well, we basically do different types of PaDe.
But
like,
is there some rigorous?
It's not rigorous. It's not rigorous. But usually, like if you do like this PaDe 4.1, PaDe 3.2, PaDe 2.3, they're very close together. For example, near D equals 3. Yeah, you see that D equals 3 is even a regime where just the raw epsilon expansion would not lie too much to you in D equals 3. It would give a somewhat smaller answer. But so in the paper with Simona from last September, we just used the raw epsilon expansion, and we got something a little smaller than 90.97, like 0.96 maybe. But this is, I think, pretty nice because it gives a very good quantitative guide for what to expect. So let me conclude. Because I always thought that computing entanglement and interacting theories is just hard, right? I mean, it's like in free theories, thanks to Mark Srednitsky's technique, you can do precise calculations, but Roger told me about some recent progress in interacting theories, but this particular quantity is also a very pesky quantity because you have to draw a circle through a square lattice, which is not easy. And so let me conclude. So the universal term in this disk entanglement entropy is determined by the three-sphere free energy. That's like we all know and love this fact. This quantity appears to satisfy the F theorem, and we reviewed its various tests. There's still a slight bit of dissatisfaction I have about really finding a completely stationary C function, which would be great for the future. And then we tried to generalize the F theorem to other dimensionalities. We studied ON models between 4 and 6 dimensions, which makes sense to all orders in 1/n expansion, and they're metastable at large n, and found a new description of the UV fixed points, which in terms of cubic theory, which allowed us to also test some dimensional F theorem. And more generally, we defined in continuous dimension this quantity F tilde, which is signed by D over 2 log of S, Z on SD, which can be used to estimate the values of F for various interesting 3D entities. And this is, of course, just a long-range entanglement across a circle of radius R. I guess one question is, can this ever be compared with the actual numerical calculation of the disk entanglement for the Ising model? I thought it was really hard, but then I talked to Roger this morning, and he's doing Rényi entropy calculations of this sort, which seem very promising. And I was going to suggest that, for example, since the disk geometry is hard, one can, as a warm-up case, consider just the cylinder cut in half and extract the long-range piece, the one that's not proportional to the circumference, and also try to ask how close is this number to the free field value. And all experience we have from this talk suggests that it should be it will probably come out really close, within a few percent. Of course, that quantity does not satisfy a theorem, but I suspect it will follow a similar pattern.
I think for the Rényi entropy, as Roger found, numbers are quite close. For any entropy, the free one and the Ising one.
Right.
So that's the...
Yeah, I just heard about it this morning, and it's very promising. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
body be still be monotonic the same way?
Yeah, I
so
think.
For example, I have in mind something like the Hafler-Ludwig setup.
Right, right.
Interactive field theory, only the boundary.
Yeah, I believe you can still use the same definition.
Does the proofs do they still apply?
Well, if you use first of all, I don't have a proof in general dimension. I think the proof of Cassini and Huerta, which uses their normalized entanglement, it's a very axiomatic thing. Like, you just use the strong subadditivity inequality and the fact that you have Lorentz invariance along the flow. So as long as this is true, I think...
Is this true if you have, say,
a
four-dimensional field theory with a boundary?
Yeah.
Just below the boundary. I think so that's still true.
Yeah, it's true if the 3D boundary is Lorentz invariant. In fact, I've thought about some examples of this because, indeed, Affleck-Ludwig, of course, mainly talked about these type of examples. And they did the conformal perturbation theory calculation on a circle, which is very similar to what I showed on the three sphere. It was very similar, and again, it basically they found that this F, which was log Z, its derivative was proportional to the beta function at leading order. Okay, that was exactly the same.
Yeah, but actually the bulk will contribute part of the entanglement entropy. So when we use the inequality from entanglement entropy, we should contain the part coming from the bulk. Is it clear that we can extract that from the boundary entropy directly from that, or?
Yeah, I think you can probably ignore the bulk because if you just define the entanglement for quantities on the boundary, right? Like, yeah, the picture is something like this, right? Here is the boundary, and then this is sort of bulk. But then you draw a circle here, just on the boundary, and then you ask what's the entanglement between the degrees of just boundary degrees of freedom. I think it should.
Yeah, I think there are some examples where I think it's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You can take this so-called symmetry protected topological cases, which have 3 plus 1 D system and have 2 plus 1 D CMTs.
Right.
The known examples so far, but and
well,
then only
gap field.
If you have a gap
bulk,
then it's obvious.
And they don't even have a topological field theory very well.
Right.
So you have nothing in the bulk. But
right.
If you have a non-trivial field theory in the bulk,
right.
It's not completely obvious to me that the reasoning still applies.
Yes, yeah, no.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it fails if you don't have unitarity, which makes a lot of sense. Suppose you try and break some of the symmetries, like the Poincaré symmetry. Is there a
right.
version of this that you would conjecture, or is it known that it fails?
I think once you, for example, I believe a known counterexample is this, the form for the Fermi surface. I believe there it fails.
Okay.
Because there is this famous logarithmic term, which is not the UV logarithm, but it's log of L times K Fermi, right? And I thought I checked that the sign of it is such that the F theorem will not hold. So
I'm partly wondering if you can prescribe space-time-dependent couplings that kind of mock up an epsilon-like parameter. But at the cost of breaking some of the symmetry.
I see. Yeah, I mean, maybe there is something, but at least the basic quantity didn't seem to go the right direction for this Fermi surface theory. I have to double check it, but I believe that I looked at it a couple years ago. So far, what we know seems to rather strongly rely on Lorentz invariance. Yeah, the unitarity is always like, essentially, these general C theorems. The most general statement, right, is you have some metric on this space, right? So you'll have like dF by dGi, right, and then this has to be some metric C Cij times beta j, And this is the two-point function. It's a kind of homological metric. And this can be negative, right, for non-unitary theories.
I wasn't trying to break unitarity.
So this, I think this is sort of the reason why this monotonicity can suffer, because so in non-unitary theories, this metric Cij, can be non-positive definite.
Right, but we were talking about breaking symmetry without
I wish there was something for non-relativistic theories, but I believe that even the homologic of C theorem, right, is not true for non-relativistic.
Yeah, counterexamples.
Yeah. Oh, there are lots of counterexamples. And it can go up and down and all that kind of things.
For non-relativistic.
Oh, for non-relativistic.
For non-unitary, certainly it we have some very, very concrete cases for F theorem being violated. For even in three dimensions, you can violate it.
So do you understand why spheres are special?
Well, I guess the thermal one is basically S1 cross R, right? So it's obviously less symmetric. So I thought the sphere is the roundest geometry.
That's a very Platonic argument.
Is it possible? Is it connected to the fact that you're choosing a circle? It's connected.
It is connected to also entanglement, because it's a rather golden. It's not a completely dumb thing to say, because whenever you have some squash geometry, of course, even in a conformal theory, the number will depend on squashing, right?
Yeah.
On some ratio of two lengths. But the sphere, it has nothing to depend on, right? It's a completely just a number, a non-local number. So, and the same argument applies to the entanglement across this lower dimensional sphere. There is just a trivial area law, and then the subleading thing is just a pure number. It cannot depend on anything.
Is it obvious that if you wiggle your circle a little bit, that the entanglement entropy in that case is not going to be reproduced by some curve metric on your sphere or something?
Yeah, once you wiggle the sphere, you tend to, I think people have studied what happens. In fact, I think our postdoc Mark Mazet recently wrote a paper about wiggling the contour. And usually it tends to, so there is a kind of F maximization. I think the sphere gives you a kind of maximum possible thing. Once you start squashing the sphere, it tends to go down. So there is something. I was actually clued in for this back in when we didn't know any of this. And when you read just some papers on theories on squash spheres, you always find that that F, for example, the thermal F is always negative. So a highly squashed sphere, you'll get a negative thing. So as a function of squashing, you often get something so this is zero squashing. Let me call it squashing. It tends to always be maximized here at zero squashing. And in fact, it goes negative. One thing that you want from a good C quantity is that it's positive for unitary theories. I believe the proof that F is positive is still missing, that it's positive for all unitary theories. But you just, once you squash, it tends to go negative, and then it can become for the thermal theory. And then it tends to be always maximized at zero squashing. So there is something nice about the sphere, definitely. And correspondingly, there is something nice about entanglement across spheres. Once you start wiggling it, it tends to kind of... But I think it's people have looked at it a bit, but I'm not sure it's completely rigorous. Yeah.
The relationship between disentanglement and sphere partition function, is that true in all dimensions?
Yes. Yeah, I think this Myers, Cassini-Huerta and Myers argument is just a conformal mapping argument which maps, it's true for all dimensions. Continuous dimension, I'm not totally sure what I mean by that, but certainly in all integer dimensions, it's true.
Just following up on that, so, I mean, once you're on the flow, you're not actually computing entanglement. Only at fixed points.
Yeah. When I compute f along the flow, it has no, f, as I showed, f in conformal field theory, conformal perturbation theory is automatically stationary, because the one-point function in the sphere is zero. So stationarity comes just for free in that approach. The problem is to go some finite distance away along the flow. Then bad things can start happening, like you can go negative, and so it's hard to prove in that approach the monotonicity for long flows. For short flows, it's completely, I can just go back to that argument in conformal perturbation. Close your eyes. This. So you see that here, for short flows, it's a proof. If the fixed point is perturbative, you see that df by dg vanishes at fixed points, and the sign is such that. Unfortunately, when we initially played with f for massive fields, to begin with, it's not universal even what you mean by f for massive fields, right? It depends on how you subtract divergences. And the beautiful thing about this renormalized entanglement entropy is that it looks like a completely well-defined physical quantity, and it's monotonic, but it's just not always stationary, which is a little strange thing.
Any more questions?
I think Steve.
I again, about this unitarity issue, that suppose you have the exact solution, let's say the OM model in three dimensions, for continuous n, not large n, but continuous n. I think you wouldn't expect the theory to be unitary for non-integer n.
Continuation in n, I know that when you push it to negative n, there are these SPN theories, which we wrote a paper about them. They're certainly non-unitary for negative n.
But I think even for non-integer n, at least in two dimensions, that's certainly the case. I don't think there's a good reason to think it's unitary. So would you expect, suppose you were able to compute this f function in those theories, because do you think it would just be a happy situation where it would continue to decrease for no good reason?
For fraction.
Do you think there might be an oscillating function that would happen to
That would be really neat.
Probably the fact that the large M expansion is asymptotic might
you said there may be some.
Maybe that prevents such oscillations. I don't know.
It could be. I also wanted to say that there was this work by Slava Ryzhkov and collaborators that, in some strict sense, the theories in continuous D are actually not unitary.
Why is things so good?
It could be that there are counterexamples in continuous D. So I think there are two parts to this talk. One is a kind of more of a philosophical, what if these theorems really are true in continuous D. Of course, they will need proper definition and all that. And the other one is extremely practical, which is just find the definition in continuous D which is smooth and do epsilon expansion. And the latter definitely works.
The former needs
much more thinking, I think.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment about integer g or integer n. What happens then is that there are these composite operators for specific values of n or d which actually decouple from the theory.
Which are negative measure.
Only just that, yeah. And so there for general n and d, they're actually there in the theory. So, for example, people have argued that any fractional D theory is non-unitary.
So you might expect some oscillation that vanishes at...
The other thing is that for all these unitary theories at integer D or integer N, there are corresponding logarithmic CFTs where you don't decouple these extra fields. So it's an interesting question whether there are, what happens in a logarithmic
That's right. CFT. It could be that this series are non-unitary, but the F theorem is still obeyed, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be, because often you go to, you need to violate unitarity quite a lot to see the violation of it. Like, we actually had something in our paper which, that it doesn't happen right away. Like, as your delta crosses the, it's actually visible from this double trace formula. Like, the double trace formula, you can go below the unitarity bound. And the F form, the calculation is still valid, and then you see the violation happening, but not right away. You have to go like some way.
I have another question. So there's there seems to be some asymmetry between even an odd dimensions when I think of Top-Wachter theories. So in all space time dimensions, topological theories have non-zero.
Right.
And at least on the face of it, it seems like in even space time dimension, topological contribution, because you can't get log in a massive theory.
I have to say that these type of cases are maybe particularly hard to continue in dimension, because these topological terms appear.
Right. No,
so this maybe it's a very good question, but it may be just hard to define such theories
but
as a function.
But is there any insight you have in why they don't seem to contribute at least?
Like the in even dimensions? Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I don't know more than you do. I mean, I guess you just. 3D is a rather special case for that, where they have exactly the same type of contribution.
So I was wondering if this gives you any insight into a potential A-type theorem in six dimensions. You know, people have tried, and there's no obvious.
Yeah, we take the optimistic view, and we just say it's all part of a happy story. I don't think there is. So if you play this conformal perturbation theory, everything's okay. I know lately there is some. We should talk about it. But I don't think there is any known counterexamples to the weak 6dA theorem, where you float between two fixed points.
Any more questions?